Welcome to the Politocrat. I'm Omar Moore. It is Wednesday, October the 13th, 2021. On this edition of the Politocrat, Madam Speaker, Speaker Nancy Pelosi of the United States House of Representatives, in some audio excerpts from a meeting, a presentation, an appearance here in San Francisco, with KQED Live. She answers some questions and gives the answers that I think you might find quite interesting. I'll add my own thoughts on all of this as well. All of that is coming up next. Dear listener, hello and welcome to another edition of the Politocrat Daily Podcast. I am Omar Moore and I really do appreciate you each and every day, whether or not you listen to this podcast. Honestly, I mean, I know it's interesting. You wouldn't know this unless you did listen to this podcast, but I do hope that your Wednesday is going well, wherever you may be across the world, at whatever time you're listening to this, whichever day of the week you listen to it, whether it's a Wednesday or a Monday or a Tuesday or a Sunday or a Saturday or any day, I thank you for listening. And I hope your day, whenever that is that you're listening to this particular episode, is going as well as you could hope for. If it is not, I hope that it does improve for you, and may your day today be better than it was yesterday. And may your tomorrow be better than it is today. Remember, please, to become fully vaccinated, get 2 shots if you are taking Moderna, if you are taking Pfizer. Please, 2 shots of vaccine. That makes you fully vaccinated. If I do the math correctly, I think I do. And if you are going with Johnson & Johnson, then there's only 1 shot. As well, I think AstraZeneca in other countries, I think that might only be 1 shot as well. I'm not 100% sure. But in any event, please get fully vaccinated for those of you who haven't yet. I know that there are some people who have some grave trepidation around it. This is so important. This could save your life. Having this vaccination could save your life. I'm not even going to talk about the lives of others. Of course, that's very important. But I'm going to appeal to the selfishness in some people, because really that's what this is. You can't walk around and say, well, it's the patriotic thing to do, because people don't care about patriotism. People use patriotism. People wrap themselves around in flags and shout out that they're patriots, but they're not patriots. Remember what Samuel Johnson once said way back when: patriotism is the last refuge of a scoundrel. So it's telling people or appealing to people to do their patriotic duty is not going to fall on any ears that are listening. The deaf ears are going to be in attendance on that one. So you have to appeal to people's selfishness. I know that's sad to say, but you have to do that. So it's important that if you are trying to convince or trying to tell someone, not to convince them, but trying to tell someone to get a vaccination, tell them it could save their life, and tell them that the risk of not getting one is far greater than the risk of getting one. And that's how I think you have to address it at this point, because there's still lots of people who don't want to go anywhere near a vaccination shot. And I'm not talking about the people who are anti-vaxxers. I'm talking about people who just really have some real deep fears about vaccinations, and particularly given the history of this country and how, in the United States at least, how experimentations have been done on black women and on black men by both the medical community and the United States government, various facets of the government. So these things are not in a vacuum. So anyway, I just want you, please, if you are listening to this and you still have not yet received your vaccinations, have not got your vaccination shots, please get both of them. Please get fully vaccinated. It's so important. And there is an and involved. Don't forget to wear a mask as well. You've got to do both of those things together. People want shortcuts, and we live in a shortcut world. and a shortcut culture that says that we've got to do the bare minimum. And I reject that. We have to do a lot more than the bare minimum when it comes to our health. And so while the system that we may be governed by is all about cutting corners and doing the barest of minimums, minutia, it is important that we do more than the bare minimum, especially when it comes to our health. My goodness me, if you're not going to do more than the bare minimum for your own health, then what are you going to do more than the bare minimum for? I mean, this pandemic is still here. I know that the corporate news media presents this as if it's no longer a factor or as bad a factor. It's still very bad. It's still very bad here in the United States, in a number of places. It's still very bad across the world, particularly in the African continent, in the parts of the Far East, and parts of Europe too. So England, for example, Western Europe, England, the case rates have skyrocketed, have really crept up quite a bit now. Positivity rates for COVID, and the Delta variant is not gone away, is not going anywhere, because people continue to refuse to wear masks in addition to them getting vaccinated. And some people aren't vaccinated. So you've got to do both, because these vaccines are not 100%. So you've got to do the mask, because the masks have proven to be very, very effective. So if you do both of those together, you are in very good shape and definitely putting yourself in a good position. So having said all of that, dear listener, again, thank you very much for joining me. I wanted to talk about Speaker Pelosi on this episode, because this evening, Speaker Pelosi was here in San Francisco, California, and attended a live audience gathering. She was there in person here in San Francisco for a radio station here. I think it's a public radio station. Yes, of course it should. Of course it is. I should know this. KQED, which you can find on Twitter. And there, I'm sure they have a web address and everything else. I know they are at kqed.org/live. And that's what this was. It was KQED Live. And so there were two moderators. I forget their names now. I think Marissa Lagos and Steve Schaefer, perhaps. That might be their two names. Scott Schaefer might be their two names. I may have those exactly right. I may not. But they were asking Speaker Pelosi, who is the third most powerful person in the whole of the United States, she being the Speaker of the House of Representatives here in the United States. And she's from San Francisco. In fact, where I am, I'm literally a stone's throw from where she actually lives. And one of the things that she talked about, I'm not going to play it for the purposes of the excerpts that you're going to be hearing, but she talks about how her house, when she spoke earlier tonight, she talked about how her house was being protested upon by people who were advocating for immigration rights and immigrant rights. And she didn't seem perturbed about it at all. In fact, there's nothing to be perturbed about. The vast majority, if not all of the demonstrations that go on in front of Speaker Pelosi's house are very peaceful. They're not a threat to her at all. They just want to let her know that these are the issues you need to be taking up. And Speaker Pelosi, I don't think, is in San Francisco, but what, maybe 3 weeks out of the year? I mean, maybe a bit more than that. Maybe a bit more than that. Because, I mean, she's in D.C. all the time, because that's where she is. That's really her home, you know, a home away from home. And there, I think there was a house recess, or there's been a house recess, and Speaker Pelosi has occasion to fly back across country. So she attended this event. It was an evening, basically an evening with Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi. And so the questions came, and I just, I bet that both Marissa and Scott are good political analysts. I have not listened to their show on the KQED radio, so I really can only go by the one event that I listened to. And this is the event you're going to be hearing clips from. And I can't say that I was overwhelmed with impressions of greatness. They just did their job. They didn't do anything wrong. I just don't think that the questions were compelling enough. And I don't know if they picked the questions themselves or if someone else did. I suspect they did. But I think that the questions were very kind of, forgive me for saying, talk showy type questions. The kinds of questions that you would get for a live studio audience that would really not really challenge them or trouble them, but more titillate them. And that was the tenor for me, as far as not for me, but that was the tenor that I got from this whole event, is that a lot of the questions seemed not to challenge, obviously not to challenge the speaker, because they just weren't going to do that. Because that's a sad thing, though, you know, is that a lot of politicians won't come on shows if they're challenged. And then my question is, well, what are you on the show for, other than to obviously get your viewpoint across, which you should, you're entitled to, and to pitch whatever you're pitching, and you're entitled to do that. What good is your presence in that moment beyond the things you want to say if you are not going to or are not willing to be challenged with some critical questions that an announcer, excuse me, that a moderator or questioner might raise about you? That's not fun. That's just boring. And many politicians, particularly here in the United States, but I bet you across the world, refuse to come on some of these shows if they're going to be challenged, especially if they've gone through it before. I'm never coming on your show again. And this is what gets me, because I do want to say this as a way of preface. Keep in mind, right, that there are many black journalists who are held in great esteem and some who people just ignore, who are doing excellent jobs all over the country. And there are at least three or four that I can think of, and I'll name one of them, Joe Madison, who had tried for years to get Speaker Nancy Pelosi to come on his show. I've talked about this before here. And he had to, not him personally, but members of his staff had to basically beg, borrow, and steal the crown jewels to get her to come on. And it wasn't until maybe just about 3 or 4 months ago that Speaker Pelosi finally came on the air with Joe Madison, who's got an audience of 5.5 million people daily on his Black Eagle show on Sirius XM channel 126. 6 a.m. to 10 a.m. Eastern U.S. time. Joe Madison's been around for a long time. He has been an activist. He has been a community leader, head of the NAACP in Detroit at one point. He's been an activist since the 60s. And he's been a broadcaster since the 80s or early 90s. And why Speaker Pelosi would not come on his show for all of this time up until just a few months ago is beyond me. And as far as I know, Roland Martin still hasn't had her on his show. And he has been calling out for her for months on end, over a year now. And she won't come on his show. Not the last I've checked, as of, I think, July or August, she's still, of this year, 2021, she still hadn't been on his show. Roland Martin has an audience of hundreds upon hundreds of thousands of people a day. And he has close to, what, 1 million subscribers. Now, look, I've talked about numbers not meaning much, and that they, or that they don't tell the whole story. But in this case, they do tell a lot of the story. But there's passion always behind the numbers. The numbers don't exist in a vacuum. But the point is that that's a fertile audience of people, black people, in the case of both of these people I've mentioned, Roland Martin and before him, Joe Madison. And for Speaker Pelosi to completely disregard many millions of people, predominantly black audiences, it's just a real kick in the teeth. And it just tells you something about Speaker Pelosi, quite frankly, that I mean, I don't want to go there with her. But when I say go there, I'm not going to say, because I don't know. Is it because there's something racist going on with Speaker Pelosi? Or is it just her schedule's constantly tied up whenever Joe Madison and Roland Martin call upon her and ask her to come, please, onto our show? I don't know what's going on. I don't. I honestly don't, dear listener. But I do know with my eyes and my ears that Speaker Pelosi ain't been on the show. And I kind of wonder about that. Why? Say why. She could do a remote, but she flew across country back to San Francisco to be live in person for an audience here in San Francisco. And I mean, she's entitled to do that, though. She's entitled to fly across, come back to her native city. You know, she might be originally from the East Coast. I don't remember. I know Barbara Boxer is originally from New York City, from Brooklyn specifically. And she once lived out here. And she, of course, was a senator out here before she, I think she ended up moving to Southern California. But she's senator of the state before she retired, a few years ago. But look, if she doesn't want to do an interview, she doesn't have to. But I do find it interesting that she's doing all these other interviews, and she ain't doing Joe Madison until recently, and she ain't doing Roland Martin. And I just, come on now. Come on now. And then she will, it sounds like I'm bashing her, but I'm just laying out things that people would not want to talk about. Dropping to one knee and having the kente cloth and all of that last year for George Floyd. And you're doing that for George Floyd, who is no longer with us. But when there are black folk all around you who are asking for you to come and stop by and have an interview with them, and you won't do it, your gesture to George Floyd is empty and meaningless. And it's just a performance, and I just don't like it. I don't like when people perform. I mean, specifically politicians. Everybody performs. We all do, right, to a degree. So I want to modify that to politicians, because I know and I accept that performance is a part of the repertoire in politics anywhere. But what I don't accept is if you do this and then you don't do anything else, right? If you're voting for things that are in contravention, and Speaker Pelosi hasn't in terms of voting rights, to the best of my knowledge, but I had Shahid Buttar on here last year who was running against her, and he absolutely didn't stand a chance. But when I had him on here on this podcast, he was very clear about Speaker Pelosi. Now, granted, he's running against her, but he laid out everything. What allies of Pelosi did to him, how he got completely slated by progressives in San Francisco, and I put quotation marks around the word progressives, San Francisco progressives. I definitely put big quotation marks around those three words. And when they all backed her instead of him, and he was the progressive candidate, and all the progressive parties and groups and organizations in San Francisco genuflected and voted for and endorsed her. And she is not a progressive. She is a moderate. Anyway, I've spent more time talking about some of the things that Speaker Pelosi has or hasn't done than I have playing you what I'm going to play you. So why don't I just take a break here? And let's start with a clean slate here, okay? So that you can listen to some of these clips from earlier this evening, from San Francisco, California. I am going to be coming right back to you with Speaker Pelosi at KQED Live. Welcome back. What you are about to hear is the first excerpt of the evening with Speaker Nancy Pelosi of the U.S. House of Representatives. This took place this evening here in San Francisco, California, and it was as part of an event called KQED Live. That actually is the name of the radio station, KQED, a station here on the radio in San Francisco, a public broadcasting station, PBS station. Here in the U.S. in San Francisco, California, KQED. And they do programming like this, and I think it was simulcast over the air too. I'm not 100%, but I know that it is available on YouTube. You can actually watch this whole entire, I think it's about an hour and a half, of conversation with the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, and the two journalists And I forget there, I think Marisa Lagos and Scott Schaefer, I believe, are the two people that you'll definitely be hearing them on some of these clips. So that those are the voices you will hear other than Speaker Pelosi's. You may also hear some audio interference, distortion and noise, or a few other things going on as well. So I apologize for that. But just to let you know that if you hear some sounds or things in the background or during this, that is what that is. So without any further ado, this is Speaker Pelosi. She is responding to a question from Scott Schaefer, who had asked her, what's going through your mind on January 6th, 2021, in the United States Capitol building, of course, where the terrorist attack happened. Of course, it's not referred to in any of these clips as a terrorist attack, but it is one, as far as I'm concerned. Anyway, never mind what I think about this. It's only the podcast I do. But I think I've spoken enough. It's over to Speaker Pelosi, who talks about January 6th and what transpired.
It was a horrible day. It was a horrible day in our democracy. I was at the podium presiding. This was not just any day in the life of Congress. You've heard some of the Republicans say, well, it's just like any tourist day, and they were just like any tourist coming to the Capitol. But here's the thing. This was a constitutional challenge, because January 6th is the day that the Constitution requires the Congress to accept the vote of the Electoral College. So it was on that day that they came to disrupt that constitutional process. What wonderful day, having a new president, peaceful transfer of power, and the rest. And so that day was fraught with meaning. And of course, right before then, the inciter of the insurrection was encouraging these people to go down there and do that. But actually, we are in the chamber, and they have these mahogany boxes. And in the boxes are the certifications of the states. And then they take it out by alphabetical order and read what it is. And one of the first ones was Arizona, one of the first ones that they would challenge. So we're in the middle of that challenge. And what happens is you're in joint session. So it's a speaker and the vice president presiding. Once, and they read that Alabama, Alaska, then they go to Arizona, then somebody makes a challenge. And when that challenge has a House and Senate challenger, we separate, they go to the Senate to debate it, we debate it in the House. So we're debating the Arizona challenge.
And you were presiding, right?
And I was presiding, and security just came in and said, you have to leave. And I said, shall we say we have some exuberances in the House from the other side to, challenge this and that and that. And I said, don't worry about that. I can, I'm used to this. No, they said, you have to leave now. You have to leave now. And they just really pulled me from the podium, to the point that I had my phone there so I could be a check on the timekeeper as to the time that people were speaking. And I just didn't even take that with me, just pulled out. Went to a non-disclosed location. As soon as we got there, we could see, which was minutes away, what was happening outside. And the first thing you think of course, is the other members who do not have the kind of security the speaker has, but also the staff, especially the staff, because we sign up for this, those of us who run for office. But the staff, and many of them young, idealistic, they're traumatized. I will never forgive Ronald Reagan. What's his name?
Making up for saying something nice about Reagan.
Slipped out the Republicans for that, because they saw, they were there, they saw what was happening. Members crawling across because of COVID, we were not just all on the House floor, we're up in the balcony, and you saw some of that on TV, where the members had to crawl on their bellies like a reptile to get to the place where they could be taken out because these people were descending. So it was beyond anything that you could have ever imagined. So when people say, well, how come you weren't prepared for that? Nobody could have been prepared for the President of the United States inciting an insurrection of that magnitude. People coming armed. So when they said, well, we were just getting a photo op, no, they weren't. They weren't. So it was horrible. But what's really horrible about it, say it's now getting to be we're at this undisclosed, and they're saying, well, maybe we should just bring all the members over here, and then you could do the mahogany boxes over here. I said, no, we're not. We're going back to the Capitol. We are going back to the Capitol. And to his credit, Mitch agreed that would be what we would do, go back to Capitol. In the course of all of this, we're finding out, of course, that the Democrats have won Georgia. So
roller coaster of a day.
The next day. And what was interesting is to see Mitch congratulate Chuck Schumer. Congratulations. So we knew at least he understood what happened the 5th.
Was that pretty heartfelt, do you think? Mm-hmm. Was that a heartfelt congratulations?
What? Heart? Certainly not four-chambered, warm-bodied heart, that's for sure. So it all happens. It's now 4 o'clock in the morning, and we take the vote. And overwhelmingly, the Republican members of Congress voted against accepting the vote of the Electoral College. That was as offensive as these bozos coming in with their foul mouths and poo-poo all over the floor and the rest of that. I mean, it was disgusting. But what was really disgusting was that the members of the House of Representatives, the Republican members, overwhelmingly voted not to accept. So that's what it is. So nonetheless, all the more reason for us to pass this legislation so that we can undo the nullification that they want to do and also remove the barriers to participation.
That was Speaker Pelosi earlier this evening. Now, two things that jump out at me, dear listener. Number one, the challenges to the vote. That's exactly what happened on January 6th of this year, 2021, that there were challenges from the House and Senate on the certification of the vote of Arizona. That was one of the states being challenged, and that was what kicked all of this off. And this is all orchestrated, as far as I'm concerned. And during the course of the hour and a half that Speaker Pelosi is on stage, neither of the two journalists asks her, well, do you think there was an orchestrated effort with this particular event, this terrorist attack? They didn't ask her that. And if I were moderating this, I would have asked Speaker Pelosi that. Not that she would have answered it. Maybe she wouldn't. Maybe she would have said, well, there is a congressional investigation going on right now. We'll get to the bottom of this one way or another. And she may have answered it that way, but I would have at least asked her. I tell you, it's one thing I just don't like when journalists do not ask the critical question, not even so much the hard question. They don't ask or raise the critical question sometimes. Many journalists, there's some journalists who do, but a great many don't. They are either stenographers or too happy to be in thrall with the person they're interviewing or speaking with. And I just think that that's a real problem in journalism across the board now. I mean, there are always exceptions to this. And not every single person obviously does this. But too many do. In fact, many more people do. And they're too chummy. I mean, there was... I could go... I mean... Anyway. They're just too chummy. And it's a country club atmosphere. And it's permeating the media, especially in sports, too. Hey, buddy, I know that, and they're interviewing them. I get it. So you're a former player and they're a current player. So you want to talk to them less seriously than if you were speaking to someone that you didn't know and you were interviewing them. So it's all this frat, it's a fraternity, it's a frat house. And this was not a frat house. Obviously, what you just heard was not a frat house, and the two people that you're going to be hearing from, Marissa and Scott, who did the questioning, they're not frat members as far as I know, or sorority members as far as I know, but their approach was total kid gloves here. And I want to get to the real points. I guess I'm still ticked off about the other stuff that I talked about earlier. But the challenges came to Arizona. House member and a Senate member has to properly challenge for it to stop the count and stop the proceedings. And I just remember, I just kind of go back 20 years. Do you know what happened 20 years ago, dear listener? In the very same chamber on that floor in the Senate? Do you remember? Well, let me tell you what happened. Actually, I think it may have been in the House. But do you remember what it was in the House? Do you remember what happened? I'll tell you what happened. It was in the House floor. Just like this was in the House floor this year. 20 years ago, in January of 2001, you had black congressperson after black congressperson after black congressperson after an Asian Pacific Islander congressperson after black congressperson after black congressperson rising to challenge and object to the results in Florida. And could they get one Democratic senator to join them? These are all Democratic politicians I'm speaking about that I just mentioned. Do you think they could get one Democratic senator to join them and say, yeah, I challenged Florida? And they had every reason to challenge Florida in 2001, because as you know, if you remember this, dear listener, there was a small matter of an election from the year 2000. You know, that one that ended with the United States Supreme Court deciding who the winner was. Ah, oh, yeah, now you remember, right? Yes, yes, yes. Bush v. Gore. There's that little affair. One of the worst Supreme Court decisions that we've ever had in this country called the United States. Country in quotes. There have been many horrible United States Supreme Court decisions. That is among them. And it was very clear, and as we know, the New York Times had printed a whole big thing about this a year plus later. If, under any scenario, this recount was done in Florida, the entire state, Al Gore would have won. He would have won Florida going away. But Al Gore only asked to recount Palm Beach and Dade counties, I think, and not the entire state. Had he done the entire state, he would have won the bloomin' thing. He would have been in the White House. But no, didn't happen. And then the United States Supreme Court said, we'll take it from here. And of course, you know what happened there. George W. Bush's buddies on Supreme Court took care of business with an assist from Poppy Bush at the time. And that's what happened. Oh, George W. Bush would be irreparably harmed. Oh my gosh. So we're going to take this out of the state's hands, because we don't believe in states' rights. I mean, we believe in them except when we don't. So this is a one-time only Supreme Court decision. And Florida does not get the right to continue to count these votes. That's unpacking. This is the shorthand Cliff Notes version of that majority decision in the U.S. Supreme Court in Bush v. Gore. Florida cannot tell itself to continue counting votes. And this is the extraordinary exception that we're going to tell them to stop counting votes. That is a trampling of the 10th Amendment, if ever there was. Reserved powers to the states. 10th Amendment of the United States Constitution. There was a definite foul smell in the air. Everybody knew. There were reports from Greg Palas, my good buddy there, who I follow on Twitter, and he follows me. Greg_PALAST. One of the very best of the investigative journalists that this country has. And he deals with voting issues all the time, uncovering all this bullcrap from Republicans, all this corruption and thievery. And he's written books, he's done documentaries on this. You've got to check him out on Twitter. Now, he had uncovered something that summer or that fall during the election that said that the Republicans under the Secretary of State of Florida, Katherine Harris, purged at least 80,000 black voters from the voting rolls of Florida. 80,000. And he had all the evidence to prove it. He had all of these lists, these caging lists, names that had been taken off the rolls. Even if they weren't names of people who couldn't vote, they were eligible voters. Oh, we're going to match up these names. Oh, even though their initials are different and their last name is spelled differently, we're still going to throw them off the rolls. And they did that to 80,000 plus black folk in Florida. There's enough evidence there to show you that that was not a legitimate vote. But could we get, could those black congresspersons in January of 2001, 20 years ago, could they get one freaking Democratic senator to join them? Of course not. Of course they couldn't. They just sat there. Let's just get on with the show. And there you go. You had black folk fighting for the quote-unquote democracy and the right to actually have an open look at Florida. And then you have the overwhelmingly white male Democratic senators in 2001 in January of that year just sitting there with their arms folded on the House floor, just sitting in the House chamber on the benches with their arms folded while black person after black person after black person in the House of Representatives came up and challenged, with Al Gore presiding as the vice president of the Senate, ironically enough, or interestingly enough. It's unreal. You can't script this. But this year, 20 years later, oh, we can get Republicans to challenge it. Even though the bloomin' votes are certified, there was no fraud, there was nothing. And, oh, we get challenges. We got a House person and we got a Republican, we got a senator. Couldn't find that 20 years ago. Maybe if those Democratic male, white male senators got up off their duffs and joined the black congresspersons who freaking well challenged the legitimacy of that Florida vote, maybe we wouldn't be in this freaking situation right now. Maybe not. Okay. Yeah, but that was 20 years ago. So I don't care about that anymore. That's what some people think, I think. Oh, that was 20 years ago, Omar, don't worry. Yeah, we should worry, because now you've got Republicans all over the state, and all over, not this state, but all over the country, rather, trying to take your vote away from you. And if some of those Democratic senators had grown a pair, wherever those pair might be, might not be in the situation right now. That's one. And number two, by the way, let me just add this, dear listener. Thank you for your indulgence. Speaker Pelosi, in the end of that clip, or near the end of it, mentioned that what she was most disgusted by was not even the disgusting things, and I'm not going to repeat them, that she saw happening with these terrorists in the building that she and 534 other congresspersons, senators are. But that 147, it was the majority of the Republicans voted even in the early morning hour. And I was up watching that here on the West Coast. It was just around 4 a.m. on the East Coast on January 7th, 2021. I was up late watching it. I think I still have that clip of that audio of the video of it. And even then at 4 in the morning, there were all these votes against certification of these votes in Arizona. And that's what Speaker Pelosi just said in that clip a few minutes ago that you heard. And I have said earlier this week, or maybe it was last week, that I am going to do a podcast episode sooner rather than later. And I'm going to read out all 147 names of the Republican traitors who said, no, we're not acknowledging the votes of Arizona or whichever states it was. Arizona was definitely one of them. We're not acknowledging them. They're not legitimate. Even though the freaking Republicans in the state of Arizona and in the state of Georgia had certified the votes, audited the votes, everything. And there was nothing wrong. How many times did we see the press conferences last November and December about how there was nothing wrong and the Georgia Republicans got up there and said, look, there's nothing wrong. Secretary of State and the other guy, I forget his name now, who said, we've got to stop doing this garbage. This is a lie. These election results are perfectly fine. We've done this. We've done it. It's legitimate. There was no fraud, nothing. Just stop talking big lies here. There was press conferences every other day. Gabriel Sherman is the name. I just remembered his name. Popped into my head. That's the guy, the Republican, that kept who voted for the guy that was in the White House at the time, that kept saying, these results are legitimate. And Speaker Pelosi said there a few minutes ago, hey, you know, the thing that I really regret, that really, it leaves a bad taste, that I'm really appalled by, is that these Republicans voted against these results. Oh, they're not legitimate. I'm telling you, I am going to do an episode and I'm going to read every one of those freaking names because there's 2022 midterms coming up, right? 2022 is the midterms. And we can't afford to wait until the calendar turns to 2022 to get going here. We should be targeting every one of those 147 Republican politicians and get someone to run against them. I'm sure they're having people run against them. But we have got to put a full court press out here. The House of Representatives is in Democratic hands by just a thread. And we have got to fortify a majority. And we've got to get rid of these traitors. Vote them out. Vote them out. Vote them out. Please. Instead of just remarking and reacting to everything and how bad it is, of course it is. Can you also, those of you especially with much larger platforms than I, can you also impress upon people that they have to act? That they have to get involved? That they have to do the right thing. Please. You have to get involved here. Vote these people out. And you have to run people against this lot. Vote them out. They don't want to respect what you, the voter, has done. Get rid of them. Vote them out of office. That's what I mean by getting rid of. Vote them out. I'll be back in just a moment with another excerpt from Live and In Person with Speaker Nancy Pelosi, KQED.
On the day the joint session of both the House of Representatives and the Senate was to certify the election results, Al Gore, in his dual role as outgoing Vice President and President of the Senate, presided over the event that would officially anoint George W. Bush as the new president. If any congressman wanted to raise an objection, the rules insisted that he or she had to have the signed support of just one senator.
Mr. President, and I take great pride in calling you that. I must object because of the overwhelming evidence of official misconduct, deliberate fraud, and an attempt to suppress
the chair must remind members that under Section 18 of Title 3, United States Code, no debate is allowed in the joint session.
Thank you, Mr. President. To answer your question, Mr. President, the objection is in writing, signed by a number of members of the House of Representatives, but not by a member of the Senate.
Mr. President, it is in writing and signed by several House colleagues on behalf and myself of the 27,000 voters of Duval County, in which 16,000 of them are African Americans that was disenfranchised in this last election.
Is the objection signed by a member of the Senate?
Not signed by a member of the Senate. The Senate is missing.
Mr. President, it is in writing and signed by myself on behalf of many of the diverse constituents in our country, especially those in the 9th Congressional District, and all American voters who recognize that the Supreme Court, not the people of the United States, decided this election.
Is the objection signed by a senator?
Unfortunately, Mr. President, it is not signed by one single senator.
Unfortunately, I have no authority over the United States Senate, and no senator has signed.
Mr. President, it is in writing and signed by myself and several of my constituents from Florida. A senator is needed, but missing.
Is the objection in writing and signed by a member of the House and a senator?
The objection is in writing, and I don't care that it is not signed by a member of the Senate.
The chair will advise that the rules do care, and the signature of the senator.
Not a single senator came to the aid of the African Americans in Congress. One after another, they were told to sit down and shut up.
And it's a sad day in America, Mr. President, when we can't find a senator to sign
the gentleman,
objections.
Gentleman will suspend.
Won't sign objections, Mr. President.
The gentleman will suspend.
Yeah, the gentleman will suspend. And there you go. I wanted to play that to you because I want you to understand everything I say here is factual. I don't come on here and lie to you. And if I get something wrong, I will say so, and I will correct it, and I will apologize. Because that's what I do, and that's the right thing to do. Not everybody does that. Most people, many people do, but not everybody. That is what you just heard there, is from Michael Moore's film Fahrenheit 9/11. That was from back in 2004, that's when the film was out. What you were hearing was from exactly the time period I was telling you about just before the break, which was January of 2001, when, as you heard, black congressperson after black congressperson stood up on the House floor at the joint session for the vote certification and were saying, I object to these results in Florida because of all of the voter theft by these Republicans, these vote suppression activities by the Republicans, taking black voters off the rolls, all kinds of garbage was going on. And none of those Democratic senators, again, overwhelmingly white men, not one of them stood up and said, I object with you. Not one of them. And the Vice President of the United States was standing up there presiding over this whole thing. Al Gore. You could not make this up. It was about him. These election results, these black members of Congress were actually going to bat for him. And he's presiding over the Senate because, of course, when you're Vice President, you are President of the Senate. So right now, Kamala Harris, the Vice President of the United States, is President of the Senate. President of the Senate. And it's incredible. And he said, the rules care. The rules, it's about you, Al Gore. They're going to bat for you to be in the White House. You got robbed of your victory. You won the blooming thing. It's just, again, that's when a system really shows its backside to you. When a system shows its ass to you, it comes at you and it's larger than life and it's right in your face. And the system's literally mooning you. And that's what it was doing. And it was doing it to all of us, especially to us as black people. And we were the only ones standing up for democracy, so-called democracy. And all of these white male Democratic Party senators sat there, arms folded. You go watch the video. I just played you the nearly 3 minutes of audio from the video. Watch the video of it. Just go search YouTube and watch what I'm talking about. Not a single Democratic senator joins with House objections to Bush v. Gore. Fahrenheit 9/11. Go look it up. And you can watch it with your own two eyes. If you are fortunate to be able to see, please watch that clip. Because 20 years after that clip, you had earlier this year, on January 6, 2021, Republicans jumping up and down, objecting to results that were absolutely certified and correct. And yet they got objections. They got House and Senate members to object to results that were already certified and factual. Oh, no, we don't recognize it. Ugh. And the bloody things are absolutely certified. No fraud, nothing. But they're screaming and jumping up and down. And then you got a terrorist attack on top of it. And then you have 147 of these traitors voting, oh, no, we don't recognize the results. Voting against recognizing the results for these states. Even though we have Republicans in all these states doing the count saying they're legitimate results. Oh, but they got their objections. But when the black congresspersons from 20 freaking years ago stood up, one by one, as you just heard, dear listener. And excuse me, I'm getting a little hot under the collar here. When they stood up, oh, where's the Democratic senators? So the Democratic black politicians stand up and say, hey, black voters are disenfranchised. And where were these white male Democratic senators? And any white female ones to be, while we're at it. Because there was certainly some there. Dianne Feinstein was still in the Senate then. Barbara Boxer was still in the Senate then, as far as I know, 2001. Well, it's just absolutely ridiculous. Oh, but we won't. Now you're old. Voting rights are very important. And where was your ass 20 years ago? When those black congresspersons needed you to stand up. But these Republicans now, 20 years later, oh yeah, we're gonna object to results that are actually factual and certified. We're gonna object to them. And they got the objections. It's just absolutely absurd. But again, that's what happens when you have a system that does this, that bears its ass to you. And without apology. I mean, it's just, anyway, I don't want to get any more. I don't want to get scatological. This is just, I'm telling you, that's what happens. So when Speaker Pelosi said that she was disgusted at the 147, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I'm also disgusted at all of those Democratic senators, all of them, who sat on their hands and did not jump up and join the black House Congress members. That, to me, is a big sin as well. Maybe we would have been able to avoid these wars in Afghanistan and in Iraq had they stood up and spoken out. Because as you know, all that is required for evil to triumph is for good people to do nothing. Welcome back. And so here we are. This is Wednesday, and thank you very much for listening and for your time. Very important, your time, and I respect it and value it. And I know this episode may have gone on a little long, not in an entire surprise, but I do thank you for sticking with me, dear listener. I really appreciate you, and thank you indeed again for your listening ear. So this next clip is going to be about roughly 5 minutes, a bit less than five. It's going to be Speaker Pelosi speaking about the things at stake, the things that must get done that the Democrats are working on to get done for this infrastructure bill and also the budget reconciliation. There are the $3.5 trillion infrastructure bill, which now is, you know, we'll see what happens with it. We'll see if it goes up or, you know, if there's going to be less or more money. But anyway, I don't want to spoil that for this clip because I think Speaker Pelosi, it reveals what the story is on that. But here's the clip, roughly 5 minutes long. And just listen to this. I think this is an important part of this particular appearance that Speaker Pelosi made earlier tonight. Because I think, you know, again, as I said earlier, a lot of it, I think, and it's not her fault. It was the questioners, Marissa and Scott, asking her things about photographs. Oh, we're going to show you some photos. No, we don't need that. This is the third most powerful person in the country. And, oh, okay, I get it. You want a little levity, but showing her photos like it's, this is your life? Come on now. You could have, anyway. Oh, dearie me. Okay, let me get out of the way. Let me get out of my own way first before I get out of anyone else's. And then I'm going to play for you this clip. Listen to this from Speaker Pelosi.
Maybe older or disabled or something in the household beyond children, or children too, but nonetheless to have not only the resources to do that so those people can go to work and pursue their careers while their loved ones are cared for, but also to have respect for the people who will be doing that work, to train them, to pay them adequately. This is central to family. Okay, so we child care, child tax credit, home health care, universal pre-K, and other aspects of workforce development. It's a personal piece of this that enables us to have women and people of color, many more people in the job. With all due respect for the infrastructure bill, 90% of the jobs go to men, which is a good thing, okay. But we have to get women into the workforce for those non-traditional jobs as well as for the traditional jobs as well. And then I didn't name everything, family and medical leave.
It's a big bill.
It's a big bill, but I don't know if we have time for that.
Okay. Well, we should. Because the country needs
how many pages?
And then the third piece is the health care piece. Strengthening the Affordable Care Act. If you strengthen the Affordable Care Act and you expand Medicaid to the states that didn't accept it before, you have almost universal coverage. And then to expand the benefits of Medicare. So health care, family care, climate, 3.5 take us right into the stratosphere. Now we have to bring it down. So it's lamb eat lamb. You know, everything is good. What do we keep? Is it a timing thing or is it a prioritizing? That's a negotiation.
But that's how do you decide?
How do you think about that? Like, all of these are clearly priorities.
I mean, ultimately, it has to get approval from Sinema and Manchin, right? So, like, how do you decide?
Well, it is I think the more the public knows what's there and how it affects them. Now, one of the, shall we say, observations that has been made is there's so much in the reconciliation that the public just doesn't really know what it is. But overwhelmingly, they support it. And guess what? Women more so than men.
Isn't that
funny? But men support it in a big way. But women understand what this means. This is about women in the workplace. This is about women taking the rightful place. This is about women not going to work and worrying about what's happening to their loved one at home because there has been. And by the way, I was just in Europe for the G20 and the NATO meetings. When I explained this to people there, they all have this. So you don't have that? You don't have family medical leave? You don't have all these things? But most developed countries have these things. And we just really believe that when women succeed, America succeeds, and we're going to make this happen in this bill. And again, it's the right thing to do, but it's better for the economy if we do it. Pragmatically, it's a better thing to do.
Well, on that, I mean, you obviously have a bigger job than just the policies you personally support, you know, to help shepherd this, but you are all thinking about the trade-offs you're going to be making, and you mentioned communication as a challenge after the ACA passed. I mean, what do you think is most important in terms of people feeling the impacts? Is it, to your point, to shorten the lifespan of some of these programs so that they're all in there? Is it that you might have to give up some of these wonderful programs that you like?
But what we really want are results for the American people. So when you make evaluations about these, you can shorten the time frame. If you shorten it too much, you lose the continuity and the impact. So it's not like something you put in a computer and something comes out. It's judgments that have to be made, and it's hard because there's so many good things. But as I say, It's lamb eat lamb. It's not like, oh, well, we can get rid of that thing because nobody ever wanted that in the first place. But our committee chairs know that they wrote these bills with their committee members. They know how if you have this, you can't have all of this. And now what gives the best result for the American people? And it's not the last bill we will be writing.
I appreciate that clip, by the way, from Speaker Pelosi, because what she said there shows you about what the realities are. We can say what we'd like to have in these bills, and she enumerated things from the bill. But whether or not all these things get in or not, or whether or not there's enough of each of these things or not, is quite another story. And that happens during the negotiations, that happens during the back and forths. So I thought that, I appreciated that those comments you made there. And I hope you did as well. I mean, this giving you a little bit more insight into the process. And one of the things, as I have said here on a number of occasions over the last few weeks, dear listener, is I endeavor to, as we continue in the run-up to the 2022 midterms, which are just over a year from now, I endeavor to continue to play much more of what's going on in the United States Congress, House and Senate, so that you have an idea of what's going on there, and also to spotlight some of these races in your state, or at least in some states. Maybe not yours per se, but in some of the states that are going to be very important. And well, all the states are very important, but the races that could go one way or another in some of these states. And also, I'm going to keep saying, like I've been saying from the very start, particularly last year, is to get active and get involved. We have to. Just pointing out that something is wrong ain't enough anymore, in my view. We have to also get involved in any way we can in terms of organizing, in terms of donating, volunteering, educating each other about voting and about the importance of voting. Educating each other about registration and what the laws are in your state regarding voting and ID, if there's voter ID laws in all these states, with these Republicans passing in their state legislatures this horrible and illegal, quite frankly, laws, these provisions that are illegal. Not just anti-constitutional or unconstitutional, they're illegal. Thanks to, well, they've been made permissible thanks to, of course, the U.S. Supreme Court in 2013 in that horrible decision then, right? You know the one, Shelby v. Holder. So, look, this is, we have to get involved. I'm going to keep hammering this home until the cows come home. But the next clip I want to play you from the evening with Speaker Pelosi that took place earlier, just, you know, not too long ago, actually, here in San Francisco, California, is this clip. This is a clip from when Speaker Pelosi first ran for office. She had said, actually, and it may come across in this clip, I'm not sure, I don't remember, that she had never intended to run for political office, which I find fascinating. Speaker Pelosi has now been in politics. This is really something. She's been in politics now for 35 years. I mean, almost 35 years. Certainly 34 years. This is incredible. This is someone who says that she never intended to run for political office, ever. Never, ever intended to. And now she's the third most powerful person in the United States of America. See? You never, never know. You never, ever know. And I bet you when she first ran, she never envisioned that she would be the third most powerful person in the country. Maybe she did at some point, but certainly not at the beginning. And here she is now, Speaker Pelosi, in this form of KQED Live, talking about the beginning, her run in 1986, amongst many others, for the 12th Congressional District here in San Francisco. That is exactly what she ran for, to be the 12th Congressional District Representative. That would be for the whole of San Francisco County. and she ran back in 1986. You've got to listen to this. I find this to be quite interesting and fascinating as well. Listen to the next few minutes of this, the process of running, and then what happened once she got to the house.
Well, I had never, ever intended to run for office. It wasn't anything I aspired to. It wasn't anything I wanted to do. I had 5 children. 4 of them were in college. 1 was in high school, going into senior year in high school. And that was nothing compared to that. I mean, that's the joy of life. So when I was asked to run, I went to my daughter, Alexandra, who was the youngest. And I said, Alexandra, Mommy has a chance to run for Congress. I don't know if I'll win, but I've been asked to run for Congress. Now, I love my life, and I love being here with you. Where another year, it would be an easier decision for me because you'd be off in college already. I'd be gone like 3 nights, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, or Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. That's the way they do it, you know, 3 nights, 4 days, and then you come home. So any answer is fine. Any answer is fine. I'm happy either way, she says. Now, this is 34 years ago. Mother. So I knew I was in trouble, right? Mother. Mommy has a chance to run. Mother, get a life. I had never heard that expression before. That was 34 years ago. Get a life. What teenage girl would not want her mother gone 3 nights a week? So anyway, the person who was in office, Sala Burton, was my dear friend. I loved her so much. And she was the one who said, you have to run. You work. I was chair of the California Democratic Party. You volunteer all the time to elect people because you care about policy. Now go do something about policy. And this is where you should be. And so promise me that you will do this, because she was not going to run again. But I thought that meant like next year or the year after, you know, within the 2-year cycle. Promise me. And so I did, that I would run, and I would, if I went run, I would try to win, right? And it was, everybody ran, right? It was like 4 supervisors, and I had never run for office, so I was like an unknown. That probably was an advantage. But John Burton was my campaign manager. He's in some of those pictures there that night, John Burton. And so, be ready, ladies. But I want to tell you, not to tell her, but to tell you, be ready. You just don't know what opportunities may be there. Take inventory of what your strengths are. Put a gold star. You're going to say, well, I'm just a mom. That's a big deal. Whatever it is, you are uniquely you. Nobody like you. Your contribution is individual. And I say this to young women and young men, or even not young, because I was coming from the kitchen to the Congress, not from college to the Congress, or younger. And just know your power, because the country needs diversity. Not only women, but people of color, young people, the whole mix of it. But just be ready. And know your power, and have the confidence that if people are reaching out to you, there must be a reason. And of course, it's not for the faint of heart. Then you become the target. See, because it's all, in the beginning, nobody's even going to... I said to John, what will happen when they take the first poll? He said, nobody even knows who you are. You'll be an asterisk in the poll. So we have to work. That's what a campaign is about. So the poll came out, and I was first. So then I became the target by everybody, and they started saying all these things. These are people that I had in my home, that I had helped do events for, and all right, Diane Kiepoffer said, that I had done events for, and the rest, and all of a sudden I was, you know, didn't know anything about anything, right? And anyways, so I go to the floor of the House, get sworn in. My father's there because he had been mayor. I mean, he had been congressman, and then you can go to the floor of the House. And my colleague said, don't say a word. When they say, do you solemnly swear, you just say, I do, and that's it. Don't say a word. Nobody wants to hear from a freshman member of Congress. Now, it's a special election, so I get this special swearing in. So when I do. And then the speaker says, does the gentlewoman from California wish to address the House? Well, of course. So these guys, you know, who had told me, they're like, short, be really short. So I go up and I thank my father and mother there, and I said, I want to thank my constituents. And I told them when I came here, I would tell you that Sala sent me, and I've come to fight against HIV and AIDS. Short. What was that? Short. Could that be shorter? I look at them thinking, sure, right? So what's the matter with you? Why did you say you came here to fight against HIV and AIDS? Why would you want people to think that's the first thing they know about you? Why did you say that? I said it because that's why I came here. But I really saw what the challenge was, that we had a kind of a, I don't say discrimination, we had some other challenges beyond prevention, research, and care. We had to deal with some of the negative attitudes. They weren't negative, but they thought others might be. And that was really my life's work for a long time in the Congress, was HIV and AIDS. And the work that people did on HIV and AIDS paved the way for marriage equality and all these other things. But again, a model for community-based, San Francisco, community-based care, prevention, and research. So we've been a real, and although we still don't have a cure, we have quality of life and the rest that has vastly improved. And it happened because of the love, the respect that people had for each other in community.
Fascinating, totally fascinating clip there from, comments there from Speaker Pelosi. There's some things that I just completely was not aware of with the speaker. Now, look, I can't even talk here. I've always described personally my feelings towards Speaker Pelosi is positive and not so. You know, I think that she at times has done a very good job. I think she is a very good negotiator in some instances, not so in others. I think that her most effective strength is as a power broker. She's somebody who has immense power. And I do think that she uses it as wisely as she can. But then there are times where I'm not so sure. I've been critical of her at times on this podcast. I have supported her at times on this podcast. I've had guests, as I've told you, I had Shahid Bhattar on here last year when he was running against her for the 12th Congressional District here in San Francisco. And he said a lot of things I was not aware of, at least some of them I was not aware of. And so that are true regarding Speaker Pelosi, her wealth and all that. And some people that matters a great deal to, so other people don't care. But she's a moderate, and again, she's been a lifer in politics, though. And the mere fact that she goes from talking to one of her daughters about being away three or four times a week, or two or three days a week, to now becoming the third most powerful person in the entire country. I mean, wow. I mean, that didn't happen just overnight, though. I mean, it feels like it did. But it didn't. This takes a lot of dedication, a lot of maneuvering, a lot of political maneuvering. She is someone who is, say what I want to say about her, or say what you might say, some of you listening, about her. Perhaps she doesn't go far enough. Perhaps she doesn't get enough done or enough things done on a level that us, some of us as progressives, those of you listening who are progressives might like, certainly as I as a progressive would like. But, you know, the fact of the matter is she has been in politics now for 34 plus years, and she's done that. Listen, you don't stick around in politics that long if you aren't someone who knows what the heck they're doing. And Speaker Pelosi not only knows what she's doing, she has proven over the long haul to be someone who knows how to wield power. And again, I fault her for what's happened. Oh, not entirely her fault at all. I do raise an issue with her about the fact that the House majority is so slender. It's not all her fault at all. Actually, it's mostly not her fault. But I think that we could have got some stimulus package done before the election. And she had promised that it would get done, or made a promise to that extent, and it never got done. And then she relented on it. And so I've criticized her sometimes. But, you know, there's things that, you know, sometimes you never will see eye to eye on with a politician. But the fact of the matter is that 34 plus years, this is somebody who is not a shrinking violet in any way. She is a persistent and relentlessly determined politician. And I think she wields an incredible amount of power. Yes, she's the third most powerful person on the planet, but she wields an incredible amount of power. And she keeps people in line. So she's not there because of, you know, she's there because she has paid her dues. And yes, I know she's rich, and yes, I know she's from a wealthy scion's family, and she's a, you know, whatever. I mean, I get that. And I get it, you know. I mean, my issue more with her is that I think she's a little bit too moderate at times. And that's my, I mean, my, the wealth, I mean, if all I talk about with the rich and the wealthy and the corporates and this and that, I think that Speaker Pelosi, and I think she can go a lot further than she has. I think that there are times that she has done some good things, and there are times that she hasn't. And I would like her to do more good things. But I just think those clips give you a glimpse, by the way, of some of the things that she deals with on the inside, and what she goes, what she encounters, what she experiences, what she goes through, what she sees. And I think it was good to play those clips so that you get her perspective, because she's never, ever going to come on this podcast. I've actually asked one of her daughters several times to have her give literally three or four minutes of her busy time. But I've never had a response back. Well, why would I expect one back when she doesn't go on platforms like Roland Martin's platform, who's much, has got a much larger platform than I, and she won't go on his show. So one would expect it to stop on this podcast. But the point is that I think I wanted to just play those clips for you from earlier tonight, because I think Speaker Pelosi, 34 plus years, I mean, that's a political lifer. And we've seen other politicians like Strom Thurmond, oh my goodness, KKK, segregationist, and Robert Byrd, KKK, segregation, who have been in politics till they were basically almost 100 years old. You know, Strom Thurmond was 100. I think he resigned from the Senate at 99 or 100. Robert Byrd was up there in age as well before he, I think he died in the Senate or retired, I forget. But the point is that these are political lifers, and I certainly don't agree with Strom Thurmond at all on anything. Racist. He's a racist. He's an out and out racist. And I know, yes, he did father a black child, and I know. And he gave her payments while he was in the Senate and before. I get that. I know. I'm just saying he is someone I just never agreed with on anything, and why would I? He was a Democrat, and then he was a Republican. He became a Republican, you know, back in the 60s, after he was a Dixiecrat in the 50s and 60s. But anywho, that's really it. I mean, I just wanted to play all those clips for you. Those, I think it was three or four clips, because you really need to see how these politicians see things from the inside. And we've got to get active, folks. We've got to get involved. We've got to also put pressure on Speaker Pelosi and any politician, Republicans, Democrats, whomever, local, city, state, you know, federal. We've got to do this. We've got to make this country a place where people would want to come and live rather than run away from and flee. We have to start making it our business to make this country better. That's what we've got to do. And that means a more informed citizenry. That means voting. That means being educated on how to vote and where to vote. That means understanding what the laws are in your state when you vote. We have to start educating each other and teach history, not this garbage about Rush friggin' Limbaugh. That will not do. And all this other garbage that is just lies and filth from these right-wingers. We need to make sure that we have a country that values everyone. And I think the importance of playing those clips, and you heard Speaker Pelosi say, we need to get more women into leadership, black people into leadership, and in Congress, black people in Congress. I think we need to get more black women in the United States Senate, don't you? There are none right now, none. In 2021, there are none black women, none. I'm going to just put it like that. There are none black women. I'm not even going to say no black women, although I just said it. There are none black women, not N-U-N as in nuns, as in, black narcissists, right? The movie. But none as in N-O-N-E, zero, zilch. Zippo, nada. No black women in the United States Senate in 2021. We have a black female vice president who used to be in the Senate. But we do not have a black woman in the United States Senate in 2021. That's just... Anyway. Anyhow, I could go on and on. But Speaker Pelosi, that was her tonight. You heard her on KQED Live. And I would have loved to have played more, but a lot of the other stuff that was on for the hour and a half, and you can judge for yourself by going to KQED Live on YouTube and searching for the video of the entire event. Judge for yourself if you watched the hour and a half or so. A lot of it is very fluffy on the part of the questioners. So I wish they had been more substantive and asked a few more probing and tougher questions. Not even such a question of being tougher, but ask questions that raise critical questions of what's going on. And I wish that they had done that, and they really did not. Anyhow, I hope you enjoyed it. I hope that you enjoyed what Speaker Pelosi had to say and that you had some insight from it. And thank you very much indeed for listening in. And I want to thank the people at KQED and KQED Live for the audio. This is greatly appreciated. I mean, this is really good, this audio, and I'm glad that you got to hear it. Thank you very much for listening. Don't forget, vote as well. I think I said that before. Thank you very much for listening to this edition of The Politocrat. I'm Omar Moore.